there, it's Frank Buckley. This week, we're sharing stories from some of the amazing athletes we've had on Frank Buckley Interviews. We'll listen back to portions of our conversations with UCLA gymnast and viral sensation Caitlin Ohashi. And we'll go to USC as well with the football team's Jake Olson, who didn't let being blind stop him from achieving his dream of playing for the football team. We'll also share Victoria Arland's almost unbelievable story of being locked in her body in a vegetative state and then emerging from it to win an Olympic gold medal and silver medals as a swimmer. And we'll also hear surfer Bethany Hamilton's story of losing her arm to a shark attack and then fighting back to not only surf again, but to compete at the highest levels. So here we go. First, here's part of my conversation with the amazing Jake Olson from December of 2018. Jake played for USC's football team as a long snapper, despite being blind.
You worked your tail off to get this. It wasn't just handed to you.
Right.
And I feel like, you know, when we talk about how you inspire folks, that's part of this too. It's not just that you're a blind football player who got into three games. It's the work that you did to get there. You earned it.
Yeah.
And I guess that's what I got out of it. What do you want people to get from your story?
Well, I think, you know, through my whole entire life, it's first understanding that and recognizing life isn't always fair. And it's full of curveballs. As a 12-year-old, I had to go blind, and that's not fair. You know, that's just, I don't think a kid should have to go blind or should have to deal with being blind, but that's how life is sometimes. My message then is, okay, when you are faced with this adversity, when you are faced with these tough situations, then it's totally up to you on first how you're gonna react, and it's totally up to you to continue to live the life you wanna live. Mm-hmm. For me, that was continuing to play sports and continuing to live a life that involved the things I love and involved a happy childhood, and obviously kept my grades up and wanted to excel in the classroom and on the field and stuff, and so I did, and I worked hard at it, and I had to figure out a different way of doing things. I couldn't just read a piece of paper anymore. I had to learn Braille. I couldn't be a quarterback. I had to figure out another position I could play. But that doesn't mean I had to forfeit my dreams and goals. That's just, at the end of the day, it's your decision. And, obviously, there's things that go along with that about having a great support system and, having the mindset. But it is a personal decision to go out there. I'm not anything special. I'm not someone who was born with a different mindset than any other person. I just made that cognitive decision to go out there and overcome my adversity.
Yeah, there's some things in life that we can control, and there are some things that we can't. And it sounds to me like you've found those things that you can control, which is work ethic, attitude, and getting it done.
Right.
To that end, when you actually play football, and being a long snapper is not easy with sight. I mean, you need to get it back there quickly.
Right.
There are a lot of things that are in the mechanics of it that in talking to long snappers, it's not just a throw it back
kind
of thing. When you're blind, that's one more challenge.
Right.
What do you see, feel, hear, experience when you're a blind long snapper?
It's just feeling that muscle memory over and over again of knowing what a good snap feels like. Obviously, with kind of the distance, it's not too difficult of, I can, obviously, if you wanted me to shoot it 10 yards over the snapper's head, I know how to do that, or that's not the hardest part. I mean, most of the part is just kind of that feel with your fingertips of spiraling that ball kind of through your legs. Mm-hmm. And that comes in any long snapper, it's really not sight that dictates that. It's just kind of that feel that you just got to ingrain in your wrist and your fingers of just being real smooth and kind of soft with it and just having it kind of roll off your fingertips like a quarterback would. No quarterback looks at his hand throwing the ball through.
Right.
It's just a feel you gotta maintain, and then obviously when you go out there you just gotta tap into that feel.
You mentioned when you came here as a 12-year-old and Pete Carroll invited you, you were one of the guys for a day. Now you are one of the guys. You've been on the team for a number of years. you're one of the teammates. Was it what you expected and wanted and aspired to as a young kid?
Yeah, I mean, it's a special place. It didn't take long for me to realize that when I was 12, and it didn't take long for me to realize that when I was a freshman here. You know, this is a very special place, and, you know, I think that the difference is all of a sudden, like I said, you are one of the guys, and you all of a sudden, you have 8 to 10, 11-year-old kids that want to meet you and look up to you, and, you know, that's special because, you know, for someone who was once in that position, I realized how much it means. So that was really cool, and, you know, it's when you talk about just football basis, I mean, it's work. You know, it's being an athlete is work. Now, obviously, you know, you want to do something where you love your work, but, you know, sure, there's days where it's like, oh, man, do it. I don't want to go to practice today, or, oh, man, I don't want to lift today. But at the end of the day, man, I mean, to be able to put on that jersey and wear that helmet with the Trojan, you know, insignia on it is something that is comes with a lot of pride and a lot of honor. And there's not a day I didn't go out there that I realized what I was wearing and was grateful I had the opportunity to do so.
That was Jake Olson. If you'd like to hear the rest of that conversation or the rest of any of our conversations today, all of them are available on iTunes, Art 19, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Next up, we go across town to UCLA and Caitlin Ohashi. I'm sure you've seen the viral videos of her floor routines. They capture the pure joy of Caitlin and her UCLA teammates. And I was surprised to learn that Caitlin went to UCLA for gymnastics after experiencing a devastating injury years earlier. Here's Caitlin Ohashi.
You talk about the Olympic path. You were on that path for a while, and then you got off. Was it an injury, or what was it that made you think, I don't want to do this anymore?
Yeah, when I was 16 years old, it was my first elite career, senior debut meet, American Cup in 2013. And my back had been bothering me for a couple weeks prior to, my shoulders had been bothering me for like probably a year or two. And right after the meet, I couldn't even touch my spine without like cringing in pain. I went to the doctor and they told me I might not ever do gymnastics again. So I went from 36 hours, kind of on top of the world of the sport at that point, and to nothing. And it was kind of, at that point, it was a relief. So having been told that I might not ever do gymnastics again, I was relieved because I might not ever have to be judged by like my coaches, my peers, my and the judges themselves, you know.
And the public
obviously,
too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because the public was, I've read, judgmental about your body or, you know, whatever, that, oh, you've gained 5 pounds or whatever it is. People freak out at when you're 16.
Yeah.
And they shouldn't be.
Right. Yeah.
Tell me about that. What was it like? Tell me about the pressure of being that young and in that sort of national and international spotlight as a gymnast.
It's a lot of pressure just because you can never escape it. So you go into the gym and you hear all about how big you look, and then you go home, and you know, for me, my parents or my mom was really invested in gymnastics, super healthy. I'd hear it from her, and then you go on social media and you hear it from the people that are following you. So you don't really ever escape it, and then even when you look in the mirror, because you've heard it so much, you start believing it. And especially as impressionable 14-year-old girls, we believe it.
And so that's why it was a relief that you thought, okay, I don't have to do this anymore.
I was miserable for a really long time in the sport, so being able to hear that it wasn't really an option, because quitting was an option as well during the time, so hearing that that was kind of my out was a way for me to escape the sport.
That's astonishing to hear, because you show so much joy in doing it now. The thought that you hated it just a few years ago, what is that, 5 years ago? You were 16?
Oh, that was, yeah.
Because you're 21,
yeah,
right? Yeah,
5 years ago.
Yeah.
I go to UCLA.
But just 5 years ago, you were hating this sport. Mm-hmm. And now you're identified as the person who has such joy for this sport. What a turnaround.
Yeah, no, it definitely took me a while to get back to that. So I think I always loved gymnastics, but I think it got the joy and like everything else got taken away super quick and at a young age. So you kind of start mixing up the two. And after like a full year, I started missing the sport and everything that I did love about it. And coming to college, I was able to experience that like times 100 and really express myself fully.
Why is it that young women at that age, and the peak really for young female gymnasts is what, like 16 years
16.
Old? How is it that you, what can we do about that? What can we do about that pressure to make it so that we're not putting that kind of pressure on young women who, it really doesn't seem fair to me as an outsider that young women at that age should feel that?
I don't know if there's a way to minimize the pressure, but I think there's a way to create an environment where they feel comfortable enough to speak out about these things and vocalize how they're feeling to their coaches and their parents and being listened to and heard. And I think that is where it becomes a healthier environment to where you don't feel the pressure as much.
Is it because they aren't empowered in that way or weren't empowered in that way that you think that those negative things that we've heard about the sport, that's how that could happen?
Yeah, I don't think they were empowered to. They weren't ever heard. I think our emotions and our voices are so frequently suppressed within that culture, and you don't even feel comfortable enough talking to your coaches about certain things. And then the parents sometimes get confused and think that they're doing the best for you. And instead of listening, they just kind of keep pushing.
Yeah. And for people who aren't aware, we're talking about Larry Nassar, who was the doctor, the team doctor for the national team, who is in prison now.
Yeah.
Let's talk about how you rediscovered the joy. How did you come to UCLA?
Right after the American Cup, it was a couple months later, and I called Miss Val. I decided that I needed to switch my goal path. I didn't know anything about college, but one of my teammates, Madison Koshin, who's now with me here, she always talked about UCLA and Miss Val and how great it was.
So, Miss Val is Valerie Kondo Field.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I called her up. I was just like, I'm interested in UCLA. And she was like, this is Caitlin Ohashi. Like, you know, you just won American Cup. And we just had this hour-long conversation where she was like, when was the last time you have been happy in the sport? I was like, I honestly don't remember. It was probably when I was 11 years old before I ever turned elite. And we got an unofficial visit set up, came out here, fell in love with the team, Miss Val, the school, the location. And kind of once I was cleared for training, I switched everything and wanted to go level 10 for my last year of high school and then come out here.
Caitlin Ohashi has since graduated from UCLA, and this summer she received two ESPY awards for Best Viral Moment and for Best Play. Now to Victoria Arlen, who you've seen hosting on ESPN and American Ninja Warrior Jr. It's what happened to her as a young girl that blew us away. It's a story told in her memoir, Locked In, The Will to Survive and the Resolve to Live. Victoria spent nearly 4 years in a vegetative state because of two rare conditions, but she miraculously emerged from that state and then put in the work to not only learn the basics of life, but she became a Paralympic swimmer who won gold and silver at the 2012 London Olympics. Here's a portion of my conversation with Victoria Arlen.
I'm crying in a way that, like, you can't show it, but on the inside I'm just screaming. Like, it's kind of like when you're underwater and you just scream and no one can hear you. That's really what it felt like. And so I felt like I was just drowning and screaming all at the same time. And I just wanted, and every now and then, tears would come and stuff. And so I think that's how my parents kind of had a glimpse that I was in there. But I was just screaming and I was like, I just need something. And so I actually had found my faith during this because no one else could hear me. So I was like, well, I either look down or I look up. So I was like, hey, God, like, if you can hear me, can you please help me? And I made a promise and I said, look, if you give me a second chance, if you help me break free from this prison. I will use my voice. I will use this second chance and make a difference and not waste a single moment. And so I made that promise. And all the while, the doctors are realizing that I'm not getting any sleep and these seizures are getting worse and worse. So they tried to knock me out with a sleeping medication. And it didn't knock me out, but it stopped the seizures because there was a chemical in the sleeping medication that shut off the neurotransmitter that was misfiring. Very crazy. But basically, everything stopped. And for the first time in a year and a half, my body wasn't seizing every single moment of every single day. And so I realized that I had my eyes and I could control my eyes. And so my mom walks in and since I was a little girl, I have these big brown eyes. And so since I was a little girl, my parents like, since you were a baby, we always knew what you were thinking with your eyes because you just have these big eyes. And I just locked eyes on my mom. And for years, my eyes were glazed over or rolled in the back of my head or just wandering. And I was tracking her. And so she's walking around and realizing that I'm staring her down. I've been waiting for this moment for a very long time. So it's a very intense stare. And she walks up to me and she's like, she just kind of took it in and then said, if you can hear me, can you blink? And I just kept blinking and I just looked at her and kept blinking. And then she freaked out and then she called my dad and was like, she's in there, she's in there. And then my dad had this heartbreaking realization like, oh my gosh, this girl's been in here the whole time. And so from there, it was really getting me stable enough to go home. And then it was like, okay, how can we help her communicate? And so it was a lot of yes, no questions. And then from there, they got on top of the seizures and realized, okay, now we got to start seeing what damage has been done. And the doctors had kind of warned my parents that there's been extensive damage. So we don't know how much is still there, but my parents are like, it doesn't matter. We have her and we're going to help her communicate and live the most normal life possible. And I was completely intact and like ready to rumble, but I had to take the necessary steps to kind of start communicating and my brothers had to be a little gentle as far as like, can we just take her out and can we go, you know, do this and that. And so it was just kind of a slow, I mean, in my eyes it was slow, but in speaking generally, it was a pretty quick progression back into the world because it was the February 2010 that I started kind of communicating more. And then I was back at school in August of 2010.
Which is how many months after your eyes tracked mom?
It was less than a year. Mm-hmm.
So in less than a year, you go from being able to track your mother with your eyes.
Yeah.
To
going to school.
Back in school.
Yeah. I mean, I was rolling around in a wheelchair and I still had a lot of deficits, but I was talking. I was in college prep classes and I was just trying to find normalcy.
You got going. You did graduate from high school. And when do you start swimming?
I started swimming actually the summer of 2010, but it wasn't by choice. I'll just preface that. I was a swimmer before I got sick. I was a big time swimmer. And after I got better and was dealing with paralysis, I was like, I can't swim. Like, this is impossible. And my brothers were like, well, we'll see about that. And so they strapped on a life jacket and took my arms and took my legs and threw me in the water and swam with me. And we have video footage, but I am yelling profanities because I had just learned profanities and I was using them to the best of my ability because I was scared. And it went from being a place of such freedom to me to a place of such confinement because I couldn't even move. And so it was another soul-crushing reminder of what was taken away from me. But my brothers were persistent, and they kept swimming with me and swimming with me. And then I eventually took off my life jacket. And almost 2 years to the day of them throwing me into the water, I won a gold medal, which was really bizarre because I was in such a place of, well, what is my life going to look like? And them throwing me in was almost me taking that leap back into the world and taking that leap back into, well, you can find your new normal. And we never imagined 2 years later we'd be in London, but that just kind of shows is you just have to take that leap and see where it takes you.
My thanks again to Victoria for that inspiring conversation. We had another inspiring conversation recently with Bethany Hamilton. She was 13 years old in 2003 when she was attacked by a shark while surfing off Kauai. Bethany lost her left arm, but not her will to survive and to compete in surfing. Here's a portion of my conversation with Bethany Hamilton. What I didn't realize until I saw the film was how, even at that age, your family, I mean, your mother said something in the film that really struck me. She said, everything we'd been working toward as a family, a room full of trophies, it was all gone after you were attacked by the shark. I don't think we all realized that this was not just you, a child being attacked, but this was a whole family. It affected the whole family.
For sure. My whole family was rattled. So, yeah, I mean, my family was so supportive of me and my surfing. And even being so young at 13, they saw how much talent I had and also the drive. And I was the girl to beat in Hawaii. Like, I was the best in my age group. I was winning almost every event. Like, just having a ton of success. And like, I think my parents believed that I could potentially be a world champion one day. Mm-hmm. And so they were all on board supporting me, and they would film me, take me to the beach, and my brothers would like really challenge me too. And they are both great watermen too. So yeah, for my whole family, it was definitely like rattling to have such a crazy circumstance happen.
Yeah. And many people would have given up. You obviously didn't. And there was a touching moment for me in the film where Mike Coots, who'd been attacked by a tiger shark himself, mm-hmm. had lost a leg. He came to you just a few days after the attack. You're in a hospital bed, and he talks to you. Tell me what that experience was like. What did he say to you, and what did it mean to you?
Yeah, so talking with Mike Coots, who he's actually still a really great friend today. I see him all the time, like just out in the ocean and driving cars. We'll say hi, driving by each other. But he's also a photographer, so he shoots me. But he surfs with one leg, and I've seen him do some incredible surfing with one leg. He's so rad. So to be able to chat with him after I lost my arm was my first like light bulb of inspiration. And this was before I even left the hospital. So less than 6 days after I lost my arm, I already was like, okay, I'm at least going to try surfing with one arm. I don't know if I'll be able to do it, but I'm going to try.
Yeah.
And he was kind of that person that put that like hint of hope that I could do it. And so, yeah, less than a month later, I was back out there. Basically, as soon as the doctor said I could go in the ocean, I went one day earlier, breaking the rules, and was back out there and popped up on my third or fourth attempt on a wave.
Yep.
And then there's no turning back after that.
And people may not realize your father created a handle.
Yeah.
On the board so you could duck dive.
Yeah. So the first, of course, like 3 to 6 months was just adapting to life with one arm and surfing with one arm. Is like I knew how to surf, but it was just doing it a bit differently. So my dad would see me paddling out into the lineup, and you have to be able to duck dive underneath waves, and that was really hard to do with one arm. Mm-hmm. So he had been sitting on the beach, and he saw a lifeguard surfboard, which they had handles on the side of these big old lifeguard boards that they would go and rescue people with. And so my dad got this like, oh, I'm going to put a handle on her board so she can properly grab her board to push it underneath the waves. So once I got that going, it was like a game changer. I could like actually get out to the lineup of the local beach breaks and, yeah, also protect myself from getting hit by the surfboard too.
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, my whole family, once they saw my determination to get back into surfing and my ability to actually do it, they're like all hands on deck again.
My thanks again to Bethany and to all of our guests on Frank Buckley Interviews. If you'd like to listen to the entire conversation with any of our guests, just search for Frank Buckley Interviews on iTunes, Art19, or any of the podcast platforms. You can also see any of these conversations as they appeared on KTLA on YouTube. Again, just search for Frank Buckley Interviews on YouTube. We drop a new podcast every Wednesday, and on August 16th, we celebrate 3 years since we dropped our first one. Thanks to everyone for listening and watching, and for your kind reviews on iTunes and elsewhere. If you'd like to give us some direct feedback, just tag me on social media at Frank Buckley TV on Twitter and on Instagram. Thanks for listening, and until next time, I'll see you on TV.